France installed a Ahidjo's dictatorship in Cameroon for 40 years, which is now a 40-year-long Paul Biya dictatorship that's supported directly from Paris.
The transition to civilian rule, including an inclusive national dialogue promised by military authorities, has essentially hit a roadblock. Now, this despite a promise made by the military ruler when he took over power.
These values, so dear to our late president, will be demonstrated and enshrined in the framework of an inclusive national dialogue that will be organized during this transition period.
The transition to civilian rule in Chad has essentially stalled, and the military ruler seems to be entrenching himself in power. Now, what's the reason for this deadlock?
Well, it's likely that the current transition president, Mahatma Debi, believes that as long as he has enough support coming out of Paris, that he's probably fine. And if you do look at the history that I outlined, he does have reason to believe that he could maybe stay in power for a long time without a civilian transition if he gets enough support from Paris. However, we also see that things are changing in the region. Tensions are getting really, really heightened. People are, they've had, you know, enough of French intervention in the region. They don't want these French-backed presidents anymore.
Amid the transitional crisis in Chad, the country has established ties with the Israeli regime. The unpopular move by the military rulers in N'Djamena is seen as a betrayal to the Palestinian cause in this Muslim-majority country. Why is the Tel Aviv regime looking for its ties with Chad?
I think this is extremely strategic for Israel. We have to understand that Israel recently was granted observer status from the African Union last year, but this is something that's very contested. It's not something that that it will be easy for Israel to hold on to. The Sahel region of Africa, you know, on a popular level, naturally has an affinity with the Palestinian struggle. This is a part of the world that has been colonized, sometimes directly occupied for several decades, much like Palestine has. It's a part of the world where in some parts, such as in Chad, people do speak Arabic and it will have direct access to some information coming from potentially Palestine and other parts of the Arab world. And it's also a largely Muslim region, and Israeli Zionism sometimes does use or often uses Islamophobia as a form of justification.
Now, our last question. It seems anti-French sentiments are now widespread across West Africa. Now, do you think Paris is going to face tougher days in its former colonies?
Yes, Paris is already facing tougher days right now. They were kicked out of Mali, and that's what people want to see all over the Sahel region and all over all sorts of different, former parts of the French Empire that want to see France leave. So I think France is already in a really rough position already right now. I think we have to be aware that, you know, France could change its strategy. It's tried to sort of reform things and soften things. There was an Afrique-France summit in Paris held by Macron last year that was all about, you know, cultivating friendship, which is a classic French move. But I do think that we have to be aware that France could change tactics, become a little bit less overt, because there's no way for France to hold on to power in the very overt way that it's moving right now. The tensions are just so heightened, and people have just had enough of whether it's the military, whether it's the French-controlled currency, or various forms of French enterprises operating throughout the region. You know, a lot of violence coming from Paris towards this part of the world.
Well, there you have it. African countries need to remain vigilant as neo-colonial powers such as France are adapting covert policies aimed at continuing their domination of the continent. I'd like to thank our guests, Ineem Richardson, for her incisive analysis. And with that, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After a committee investigating the January 6, 2021 Capitol riots has held five hearings, there is still a question as to just how much damage the hearings will actually do to former President Donald Trump. The analysis article you're about to hear has been written by the Newsweek journalist Ewan Palmer. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled, Have the January 6 Hearings Hurt Donald Trump? After the committee investigating the January 6, 2021 Capitol riots has held five hearings, there is still a question as to just how much damage the hearings will actually do to former U.S. President Donald Trump. The House Select Committee, which has spent a year investigating the events which led up to the Capitol riot, has been building up to proceedings in the weeks and months before the first live televised presentation, promising to deliver evidence that some hoped would force the Department of Justice to act and charge the former president. However, there is no guarantee that Attorney General Merrick Garland will take the unprecedented step and charge the former President Donald Trump with a crime over his alleged attempts to overturn the 2020 election results or incitement of his supporters to storm the Capitol as a last-ditch attempt to hold on to power. Even if no charges are brought against Donald Trump or any of his allies, there is still hope from the panel that their findings could at least prevent Trump from running for office again for allegedly inciting an insurrection or ruining the former president's reputation entirely by reminding the American people of his actions and rhetoric before the attack on 6th of January 2021. However, this is not the first time that Donald Trump has faced a potential legacy-destroying hearing over the past 6 years. Donald Trump is the only president of the United States to be impeached twice, with the Senate voting to acquit Trump both times. And the former president also survived special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia collusion during the 2016 presidential election. This is on top of the seemingly endless run of scandals and controversies which dogged Donald Trump over the years, from the Access Hollywood recordings to the emboldening of far-right groups and handling of the coronavirus outbreak. Speaking to Newsweek, Thomas Gift, founding director of University College London's Center for US Politics, described Donald Trump as a Teflon president while in office, and that there is nothing to suggest that his ability to avoid scandals from sticking to him has lessened since 6th of January 2021 or the subsequent live hearings. Trump's grip over the Republican Party may have loosened somewhat, but he's still by far the most dominant figure within the party. So despite the enormity of the evidence proving Trump's malfeasance, the odds that the MAGA-verse will abandon him in response to the 6th of January hearings are essentially zero, Thomas Gift said. Gift added, "It appears Republican voters may only be viewing the hearings as a replay of impeachment 2.0, where Trump was accused of inciting the attack, or as yet another witch hunt and political smokescreen designed to take down Joe Biden's most likely opponent in 2024. Democrats may be glued to the television, enraptured by every new detail unfolding in the hearings, but their minds were set against Trump anyway. For all those reasons, it's hard to see the January 6 hearings budging public opinion towards Trump even a little," Thomas Gift said. In order to build pressure against Trump, the panel already knew that they must present new findings that are not already public knowledge, such as how often Donald Trump falsely declared he was the winner of the last election. The committee was also aware that they needed to maintain the public's interest in the congressional hearings. In order to do so, they brought in former ABC News television executive and documentary filmmaker James Goldstone to help turn the proceedings into a captivating presentation suitable for primetime television. The move appears to have paid off. The first live primetime hearing on 9th of June attracted 20 million viewers across the news networks, according to Nielsen ratings. However, those numbers have started to fall, albeit with the subsequent hearings not being played in primetime slots. The first daytime hearing on 13th of June was watched by 13 million Americans, with the third on 16th of June falling further still to around 9 million Americans. The ratings appear to be backed by some opinion polls which suggest the American public is not as interested in the hearings as they go on. An Ipsos opinion poll conducted after the third hearing found that just two-thirds of Americans, or 66%, are not following the hearing closely or closely at all, compared to 33% who said they are keeping top of proceedings very or somewhat closely. However, a Quinnipiac University national opinion poll released on Wednesday, 22nd of June, gave an opposing view. The survey found that a majority of the American public say they are following the January 6 hearings either very closely, 26%, or somewhat closely, 32%. Where the hearings appear to be having a detrimental effect on Donald Trump is the view on whether he should be charged with a criminal offence over the January 6 attack. According to the recent Ipsos ABC News opinion poll, Nearly 6 in 10 Americans, or 58%, think Donald Trump should be charged with a crime for his role in the 6th of January riot. Another survey conducted by Navigator Research also found that 54% of the American public support the idea of the Department of Justice indicting the former President Donald Trump in connection with the Capitol riot. David Niven, a political science professor at the University of Cincinnati in Ohio, said that the fact that the January 6th hearings are able to focus entirely on Trump's efforts to overturn the election results could be what damages Trump. Ironically, one of Trump's great political strengths is that there are so many things wrong with him that it is hard to hold people's focus on just one thing for any length of time. David Niven told Newsweek, "Each session is a reminder that Trump lied, Trump connived, and ultimately Trump unleashed a torrent of violence against innocent people trying to lawfully do their jobs." However, Krista Ramey, co-founder of the Los Angeles-based civil litigation firm Ramey Law PC, does not believe that the January 6th hearings are hurting the former president at all, especially within the Republican Party. His group of followers are within their own echo chamber, calling the hearings a witch hunt and not bothering to watch them, so it's very unlikely to move the needle with them, Ramey told Newsweek. Republicans, who aren't necessarily Trump supporters, are much more likely to be swayed by the evidence presented in the hearings. But there's definitely a ceiling on how many Republicans will be swayed, she continued. The fact that viewership of the hearings has been modest also provides an indication that there is a ceiling on how much of the public even cares at this point. Clark Cunningham, a professor of law at Georgia State University, said the issue is not whether Donald Trump's reputation is damaged by the proceedings, but whether authorities believe he committed a crime. The question is going to be, will people be open-minded about the evidence that's been presented in these hearings? Clark Cunningham said, "The battleground is not so much did Trump win or not. Was there fraud or not? Now the battleground is, what did Trump do?" he said. "He didn't just talk about his belief that there had been fraud. He put into motion a scheme which a judge in California has described as a criminal act. But will the House hearings lead to criminal trial for Donald Trump? Ultimately, it doesn't matter if the live televised hearings ratings fall and people begin to tune out of the proceedings, or if opinion polls on Trump slightly differ in the wake of the 6th of January hearings. What matters is if the committee persuades the Department of Justice that Donald Trump committed a number of crimes during his attempts to overturn the election results in the run-up to the 6th of January attack." In his opening remarks on 9th of June, the chairman of the committee, Representative Benny Thompson, described January 6th as the culmination of an attempted coup, which was Donald Trump's most desperate chance to prevent Joe Biden from becoming president. "The committee has shown that Donald Trump knew, or that he should have known, that the 2020 election was free and fair," Ramey said. "It has shown the pressure Trump put on Vice President Mike Pence and on state officials to violate their oaths of office, and it has shown the deadly consequences of the whirlwind of hate that Donald Trump set into motion," she said. "The evidence presented in these hearings meets the burden of proof necessary to result in charges against Trump."
Aperture. In the modern era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zarine Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like the dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago, while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further, because in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient who's bleeding profusely and saying, "Oh, it's not so bad." When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea. Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anane. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana.
This is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to meet you. Councillor David Blackburn, if you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the acid tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste. They have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa, or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with it?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana.
Mm.
Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched, as far as we can, that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, and as I say, at that time, I mean, the ethical... what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anani. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. You happy? There's anybody around?
Yeah, at the moment, basically two teams have gone into administration. We've been taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call Ozan.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses, it's been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belén Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Belen and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for €2. A fridge will yield up to €10 and a system unit €4. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, €10 million. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belen's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belen's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the third world? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals and prisons, and even the gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled. But D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering 3 continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors have been sold for between 50 cents and 2 euros a piece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo and Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced and their fake recycling companies shut down. But Mobo continued to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends 130 billion euros a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. 50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about 40,000 euros. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. In January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbours. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Anané has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years, we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute so as we can't be there to check, or potentially having material in the first few rows of the container that are working order, but some material sitting behind that that's not working order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use the resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
You were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to get to the end of the container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. But we've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the controls that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. But what about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity.
I'm not getting fired!
What most people don't know is that a lot of US e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler, they'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The only solution to thwart U.S. hegemony is to firm up resistance based on genuine Islamic values, as the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown and has inspired masses in the neighborhood and beyond to stand up to outside pressures through faith, unity, self-confidence, and formation of popular mobilization units, which are all capable of defeating American imperialism, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Faith, Unity, and Resistance Thwarts U.S. Devilish Designs. Stay tuned for more. There is some grain of truth when former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan says that it was U.S. meddling which shoved him out of office last April. In a recent interview to the Sunday Times, he blasted the U.S. for its imperial arrogance, revealing that his ambassador in Washington had received a message from U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for South Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, who had threatened Pakistan with consequences if Imran Khan remained in power as premier. In the past 40 years, our leadership has basically bowed down on everything the U.S. has demanded for us, said the one-time star cricketer who, in 1970s, had captained Pakistan to victory in the World Cup. This hardly seems to be an unfounded claim or an exaggeration when we, in Iran, after ending in 1979, a quarter century of American control over our country, have, over the past 42 years, been exposed to the intensity of U.S. devilish designs through war, invasion, cultural crimes, economic terrorism, political pressures and the current threats regarding our own inalienable right to enrich uranium for our IAEA-certified peaceful nuclear projects. The US, without the least doubt, is the great Satan. And resistance is the only way to defeat it. In order to remain independent, powerful, progressive, unified, self-sufficient, self-dignified, and above all, loyal to Islam and the dynamic teachings of Prophet Muhammad and his immaculate Ahlul Bayt, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In other words, if the Yankees get the slightest chance to yank any of these values, you would simply devour it in the most savage manner. This is evident by the sorry state of affairs in neighboring Afghanistan, which the U.S. occupied for 2 decades, and now after withdrawal of its troops has not only blocked billions of dollars of Afghan assets, but is actively spreading terrorism through Daesh and similar outfits to further destabilize the country. The same is true for the situation in Iraq, where a government has still not been formed 8 long months after holding the general elections, mainly because of undue American meddling and unabated plunder of the country's vast oil reserves, while the political parties bicker over trivial matters. Syria is another country in our neighborhood which the U.S. destroyed through macabrely murderous terrorists of all hue and color, and continues to destabilize not just through its occupation forces, but also by ordering the Zionist regime to indulge in almost daily aerial attacks for President Bashar al-Assad's refusal to bow to Washington's pressures. Then there is Lebanon, where the resolve of a sizable section of people to remain independent has prompted the U.S. to resort to all sorts of intrigues to try to ruin its economy and political system. Yemen, for the past 7 years, is engulfed in flames of war as a result of its invasion by the U.S. client states of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, whose cultish and clannish regimes do not want peace and stability in the Arabian Peninsula's only country having democratic institutions and not subject to hereditary rule. Palestine, groaning for the past 74 years under the jackboots of the illegal Zionist migrants of Eastern Europe, remains an open wound on human conscience. And there will be no solution to the people's plight even if the resistance groups were to express their readiness to accept the U.S. Zionist yoke. The list of American interference is endless and spread all over the globe, including Europe, Africa, and Latin America, where Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua stand as prime examples of countries subjected to U.S. state terrorism. In view of these undeniable facts, the only solution to thwart U.S. hegemony is to firm up resistance based on genuine Islamic values, as the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown and has inspired masses in the neighborhood and beyond to stand up to outside pressures through faith, unity, self-confidence, and formation of popular mobilization units, which are all capable of defeating American imperialism.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. The first point that should be discussed about Imam is the leadership of the greatest revolution in the history of all revolutions after 12, 13 years of the great French Revolution, a revolution that had been carried out against the king and against monarchy, turned into a monarchy of another ilk. Napoleon came to power, wore the crown, and monarchy reappeared. He was in power for almost 15 years. Later, he was ousted, and the same family which the French Revolution had been formed against returned and took the matters in their hands. The Bourbons, they came to power again when the people are not in the arena. This is what happens. This did not even take 12 years. To be repeated in the Soviet Revolution. The revolution was conducted by the people, but after a few years, Stalin and his successors exerted such dictatorship and tyranny over the Soviet countries, the countries that constituted the former Soviet Union, that the monarchies before them had not witnessed in any way. The people did not have any role, but in the Islamic Republic, this is not the case. The Islamic Revolution, too, achieved victory with the bodies and lives of the people. But the people were not sidelined thereafter.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Fifty days, less than 2 months, after the victory of the revolution, a public referendum was held and the people chose the government. The people had the power to choose. The people chose the system and the Islamic Republic through a referendum and a free election. Hardly a year had passed from the victory of the revolution that the first president was elected with the people's votes. A few months after, the Islamic Consultative Majlis, the legislative branch, was formed with the people's votes. From that day until today, in other words, in the space of 43, 44 years, around 50 elections have been held in this country. The people enter the field and they are present in the field today. They chose and they cast their votes. Such is the greatness of this revolution. Imam was the leader of such a revolution. Of course, this is only one facet of the greatness of the revolution. There are other facets as well which make the Islamic Republic completely different from other revolutions. One of these facets is the role of spirituality in the revolution.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Germany, home to the second biggest Muslim community in Western Europe after France. It's also home to a growing number of racist attacks on Muslims by neo-Nazis and far-right extremists. Rights group FAIR International, which has founded Germany's first reporting center for attacks on mosques, has recorded nearly 840 such incidents since 2014. A case in point, the horrifying 2014 arson attack that gutted Berlin's Mevlana Mosque. German police are usually quick to show up on the scene, but in most cases, FAIR International says, the crimes are not properly investigated.
Just 10% they find the people who have done it. So 90%, and they knew maybe who has done it. And that shows that even the government, the police, and some people of the government are together with them.
The attacks are not limited to Muslim places of worship. Physical assaults on Muslim men and women are also an almost daily occurrence.
A 2019 study found that more than half of Germans view Islam as a threat. In the same year, nearly 1,000 incidents were reported against Muslims and institutions. And in 2020, at least one Muslim individual or mosque was either physically assaulted or received death threats almost every day.
Another report published in 2020 criticizes many European states for failing to report on anti-Muslim incidents as a separate category of hate crime.
This plan is against Islam. Everything is planned. And in Germany, the fruits, because of our history, of course, we do have people who are racist. I don't know how much percent. And that is in whole Europe.
Despite all the warnings and criticism, anti-Muslim hatred, fueled by the propaganda of new Nazi groups and the far-right opposition parties, has only grown, a reality that does not bode well for the country's nearly 5 million Muslims. Saeed Puraza, London.
Beryansk, a seaside tourist town in Russian-held Ukraine, it is rapidly developing a more Russian feel. Shops and cafes accept both Ukrainian and Russian currency. SIM cards are only distributed with the Russian calling code. The number plates will soon be changed too. Some people are getting a head start. A school. In the foyer, photos are being taken for the Russian passports that are being offered to the town's residents. I found the teachers here to be pro-Russian.
The feeling when I saw the Russian flag was like, please don't go away, defend.